Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for the fine art, needle and thread people. And back here, really, in a quick turnaround, Ilka Cochran of Mabel Figworthy's Fancies. Hi, Ilka.
Hello, Gary. It's lovely to be back. Thank you for asking me.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you're doing it. It wasn't too many months ago, and we talked about you coming back, but then you started the Royal School of Needlework certificate program.
I did, yes.
And so now, so it's like, okay, you gotta come tell us about this because you're right in the middle of it, and I want to hear what it's like right in the middle of it. So, that's going to be fun. But you posted something the other day. Oh, first we should say Mabel Figworthy's Fancies. Mabel Figworthy's. Explain what the Mabel Figworthy part is.
Right. Well, she came about because I really like Flanders and Swann, which is a sort of comic English duo from the 50s and 60s. It's how I met my husband, and not in the 50s and 60s, I hasten to add, rather later. But they do comic songs, and they're just great fun. You can find them on the internet. Michael Flanders used to do introductions to the songs, which were really quite as funny as the songs themselves. And in one of them, he mentioned a girl named Mabel Figworthy. He said that they'd been on tour to Canada, and Donald Swann, his partner, was coming home with 125 pounds of excess baggage. He said, in the end, we had to leave her behind. and that was Mabel Figworthy. So when I was looking for a name to use on forums and online, where I didn't want to use my own name, I picked that one, and so when I started the business, I thought, yeah, might as well. So I did.
There we
With
go.
Permission.
As it's evolved, you actually are known almost to many as Mabel more than Ilka.
Oh, definitely. Yes, yes. I do get emails addressed to Mabel. I'm perfectly happy with that. I rather like her.
Yeah. No, I think that's the fun part, is you have this dual personality thing. Yeah.
I do, yes. I can blame anything that I don't like on Mabel and the other way around. It's a good way out.
Perfect. Well played. Okay, so you posted the other day on this is a discussion that has come up, but I enjoyed your article because your blog is Mabel Figworthy's Fancies, and you post there quite regularly. And folks, it's worth following. I've enjoyed it for several years now. And
Thank you.
You posted a discussion about basically whether it's smart to specialize and learn, say, a handful of stitches well, or to be more of a generalist and learn several things. And you're one of those who does several techniques, so I relate to you very closely. And
yes, you'll try anything, won't you?
Darn right I will. Yeah. Put it in front of me. I'll give it a go. But it's just an interesting discussion, because I think that the needlework hobby is one area where if you try different things, I think the whole boat gets raised. You actually develop better skills in the technique that you prefer for having tried other things. And
I would definitely agree with that. And in a sense, when we say being versatile, of course, it's all still embroidery. It's not as though I'm doing embroidery on one occasion and then I'm sort of mending an engine on another. So how versatile is versatile is another question that raises, I think. But within embroidery, I've always felt that if I know about, not pretty much anything, but if I know about a lot of different things, it gives me a wider range to work from. And so if you don't know something, you can't say, I'm not going to use it. You haven't got the option. So I like the idea of trying out lots of different things, and partly because it will show you what you like and what suits you and what you're good at. I found that a very productive approach. But I do know people who stick with one technique their entire lives and are perfectly happy with that. And I would never decry anybody for you know, doing only hardanger, only cross stitch. If that's what they enjoy, then, you know, by all means. But to say that trying everything, the post that you refer to talked about Constance Howard, who set up a an embroidery sort of department at one of the colleges of art. And so quite a grand lady in the modern embroidery and instrumental in, or influential anyway, in people looking at embroidery as an art form, just as much as painting or sculpture. So, you know, in that respect, I greatly admire her. Also because she had bright emerald green hair and seemed to be able to carry that off, which is quite a feat in itself.
Yeah, that would be a talent, yes.
but so I was slightly diffident at seeming to disagree with her, because she was the one who said, what was it? You don't need to know hundreds of stitches, but you do need to use the ones you do know well. Now that I have absolutely no, the latter bit, I have absolutely no argument with. You know, what you use, you have to use well. But then later on, she said something about versatility can actually work against your creativity as a textile artist. And there, you know, she and I definitely part company. I don't know about you, but I'm assuming you're on the versatile.
Right. Oh, very much so. Very much so. And see, I see that. You know, just a simple example in your hardanger work, where, mm-hmm. you know, the traditional white on white. I mean, you have in your designs have made such effective use through the years of color in your hardanger. And I mean, it's a simple example, but it's really illustrative of this whole thing. Is you've taken color and put a different dimension to your hardanger designs while staying mm-hmm. true to the stitches. And
yes, it's an interesting that one, because listening to Fiber Talk, I heard you discuss with either Arlene or Vonna about the how effective it can be to use just one color. I think, yes. Was it Jacob de Graaf?
Yes.
Who does a lot of the monochrome?
Yes.
Stuff, and in a sense that's really true. You don't need color, and hardanger in its traditional form is absolutely lovely. I think I felt that color was my way of sort of making it my own, and I'm very aware that it's not traditional and that purists may very well frown on it. And by the way, if you can hear slightly odd noises, it's because I'm trying to pull a needle through at the same time, and my cloth is very tight in its hoop. Where was I? Yes, traditionalists and purists may frown. And so if I do deviate from a technique, I do try and indicate that. So I did a few pieces of Ukrainian inspired stitching. They were inspired by Ukrainian white work, but they are definitely not Ukrainian white work. I mean, you know, they wouldn't be recognized as such, but they do have a number of the stitches from that technique.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, I put just that. I put inspired by Ukrainian white work, and I have given them Ukrainian names, but that's more as a sort of tribute than pretending that they are, if you like, the original, the real thing. But again, if I'd never stepped beyond the cross stitch that I started out with, I wouldn't have learned about Ukrainian white work and the lovely stitches that I can incorporate. If I hadn't listened to Fiber Talk so much, I probably wouldn't have got back to trying out bits of needlepoint. Thank you very much, Gary.
No charge for that.
Because I really needed something else to do.
Yeah, you were bored, right?
Oh, yeah, terrible. So, yes, on the whole, I think it's a really inspiring thing to try new things, if only to find out what you don't like.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if we're going to look at this as art, to look at it as art and then always be purists and not ever budge from the original technique is kind of counters the definition of art. You need to explore, you need to try, there needs to be variation and boundary breaking. And
yes, gosh, I've never really thought of myself as a boundary breaker. Terribly law abiding. it's nice to know that I've got this little bit of anarchy in me after all.
Yes. You didn't realize it. No, but I mean, we have to do that. We have to do that because, and there's a place, you know, I say that, but there's still a place, and believe me, I am the first guy to sign up for purist, perfect, original. This is the way it's always done, because I love that, especially with things such as Hardanger, where it's such an old world technique, white on white. It's what we had at the time, white thread, white linen. I love that history and that tie to it. But if you're going to find new levels, you simply have to break out of that and try other things. And if it involves combining a stitch that doesn't belong with traditional Hardanger, fine. Mm-hmm. If it involves color and then you have to try it if you're going to find any new levels. Otherwise, we all stick in our little isolated channels and the whole thing never goes anywhere.
No, that's right. And I tend to think of this as the individual embroiderers at the time. We talk about traditional Hardanger or Hardanger as it is always done. But I bet if you got the embroidery from a dozen different women from the 18th century together, or 19th, and put it together. Some of them would favor some stitches, others would favor other stitches, others might have tried a combination that none of the others had ever tried, and probably her friends would say, oh, that's an interesting one, can I take that? And before you know it, that's traditional as well. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to be a bit careful when you say it's traditional, which tends to mean they did that 100 years ago. But 200 years ago, it might not have existed, or they might have done it quite differently. So I think it's always an evolving thing, any art, but embroidery as well.
Yes. Well, look at how many stitches came out of mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, people, this is how you do a stitch, and then they do it wrong, but hey, I like this, so I'm
but
going
the effect
with it.
Is- Yeah, yeah, the effect is good, so why not?
Right.
Well, at the moment, for example, I'm doing split stitch in silk. And with split stitch, you go forward by a stitch length, and then you come up in the stitch, splitting the thread, and then you go forward a bit again, and so on. So it's a bit like backstitch in that you go forward and then backward again. But you split the stitch from below, which is quite tricky because, of course, you can't see where your needle is.
Right.
So you're working very much on experience. You've got to do it an awful lot, and then you get a feeling for where the needle is and where you're going to bring it up. So people who thought, gosh, this is too much like hard work, then did it slightly differently. They made a small stitch, and then they came up in front of that stitch and went back into it from the top. So they split it from the top, which is obviously much easier because you can see what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which at that point was wrong. That was the wrong way to do split stitch. But in time, it became recognized as a separate stitch, and it's now known as split back stitch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's equally effective. The only thing is it uses quite a lot of thread because at the back of the work there's more thread use. But so there you go. You start with something, somebody saying, oh, that's too difficult, I'm going to find an easier way. And suddenly it's a separate stitch, and you find it in stitch encyclopedias and so on, which the original stitcher probably would never have expected.
Right, right. No, and I think that's the fun of needlework, is that constant evolution, even today. Because you would think, well, here in 2019, all of the evolution for needlework is over with. I mean, how much more can there be done? Yet it happens all the time.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. If not in in stitches and colors and material use, then it's in the subject matter. in the urban stitching, people are stitching things that their grandmothers would definitely not have thought about. And, you know, it doesn't float my boat, but there you go. It's each to his own, and it exists, and it's yet another development. So that's quite an interesting one as well. But going back to what you said about being a purist and signing up for how it's done, that sort of sits quite neatly with the Royal School of Needlework thing. Because when you sign up for that, you know what you're signing up for. You're signing up for learning how it is done properly.
Mm-hmm.
And properly means the Royal School of Needlework way.
Right. Well, but see, that's what I've said this before. That's what appeals to me. And it is why I would move a small mountain, I think, to take a course from the Royal School, mm-hmm. is just to learn that, to get that foundation of how one of the most highly respected operations in the whole hobby, with all their history, this is how they say it should be done. Whether you stick to that down the road is immaterial. It's that's base.
That's very much my point. You learn how to do it, and then when you've got that at your fingertips, you can decide that you want to do it differently, or you don't want to do a particular thing the way they do it, but you know how to do it. And when I was teaching English, occasionally students would start being creative with language, and that in itself, you know, I applaud, and do please be as creative as you like. But I would tell them that it's often more, it's easier to play with language if you know what you're playing with. So you need to be quite confident in a second language or a foreign language before you can start playing with it. Now, that's not to say that unless you're absolutely perfect in your second language, you're not allowed to play with it. Of course you are. But your language play will be much more effective the better you know that language, whether it's your own language or a foreign one. And I think that's the way with embroidery as well. The more you learn, the more you can decide which bits you want to stick with and which bits you're not going to bother with.
Yes. Yeah. Now, let's start from the beginning on this thing. Now, you're an experienced stitcher, designer, several techniques, mm-hmm. been doing this for a long time, much longer than I've known you. And then you decide to do a certificate program with the Royal School. What prompts that thinking? Because, I mean, you certainly have the experience that you could stand on your own. You don't need that.
I don't think anybody needs the certificate. It's definitely a bit of a luxury. But most of what I learned was learned from books. I started stitching seriously when I was 19, which was 1989. This was way before I had access to the internet, I'm sure there was an internet, but it wasn't very big. And so if I wanted to learn anything, I went to the library and got out as many books as I could find and read them and tried them. And later on, that you got videos online and other types of things. But it was generally that I would look up books or articles or videos and then have a go. Which means that in a sense, possibly some things I am doing, quotation marks, wrong. They work and they're very effective, but they're not the traditional way, rather than the correct way. Yeah. So, first of all, I just thought it would be helpful and interesting to learn it that way. So I did an awful lot of day classes and workshops with the Royal School of Needlework. And in fact, over the summer, I'm doing a 3-day goldwork class, which I'm really looking forward to, because that's actually at Hampton Court Palace, which is always an added bonus.
Yes.
And so just getting a taste of a slightly more formal approach to it, I think, And then while I did an individual class at Hampton Court Palace, the tutor said, have you ever considered doing the certificate? Because I think you'd be really good at that. And I said, well, thank you very much. And I bet you say that to all the girls.
It's a recruiting ploy.
Yes. Hey, we need the people. But at that point, it didn't feel right. It's quite an expense. The certificate consists of four modules, two of which I wasn't particularly interested in. And so I just sort of shrugged it off and said, no, that's not for me. I'll just stick with the day classes. Thank you very much. And then I don't really know what changed my mind. It's partly that in the next few years, my husband and I are hoping to wind up the day job. And when that happens, I won't be quite of retirement age yet. But I don't want anything full time because obviously I would like to enjoy my husband's retirement with him. And so I thought, well, if I can up the teaching a bit, you know, just do a bit more workshops and courses and teach possibly a bit spread out further around the country. And I thought, well, if I could sort of put on my CV that I've done the certificate, surely that would sort of up my desirability as a sure. as a teacher. So that was one of the considerations, I think a main consideration. And then being me, I wrote to them and said, look, I really love the idea of your certificate. Can I change it? And because, you know, I really just want to do the gold work one and possibly the crewel embroidery one, but I don't really want to do the other two. And can I just do those two and then the diploma in gold work, the diploma being the next step up?
Mm-hmm.
And the education manager was really very, very helpful. And we had a good sort of correspondence about that. And she said, well, yes and no. Everybody starts with crewel embroidery. There is no choice about that. If you want to do the certificate, you start with crewel embroidery, which is crewel embroidery is basically embroidery with wool.
Yes.
Traditionally on twill fabric, doesn't have to be. It's the wool that makes it crewel embroidery. And they do that because, in a sense, it's the most forgiving technique. If you have to put it technically, fudge a stitch in wool, it's a lot easier than if you're working in a single strand of silk.
Mm-hmm.
Because the wool spreads. It's, you know, it's a bit elastic. It's right. fluffy. And so it's quite forgiving. And also it contains an awful lot of the techniques and the stitches, which you will later use in the other modules. So I said, okay, well, crewel work was one of the ones that I considered anyway. So happy to start with that. And then they said, yes. And then after that, you can go straight on to gold work, which is usually, I think, the fourth module. But they said, no, we're happy for you to do that. It's quite an individual program anyway. And if you want to continue after that and do the other modules, that's fine. If you want to stop there, then you just stop. The only thing is, if I only do two of the modules, I will not get the little bit of paper that says you have the certificate. I will only be able to say I have completed these two modules of the certificate.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable. Yeah,
perfectly reasonable. And from my point of view, that's fine. If I can say, look, I've done those modules for the certificate of the Royal School of Needlework successfully, I hope, then for my purposes, that's fine. And, you know, after two modules, I may think, oh, well, actually, I'm rather enjoying this. I've got the time now, because by that time we'll probably have a bit more time, work having stopped a bit. And then I might say, yeah, I will continue with it after all. So it's, as I say, it's quite an individual sort of program. You decide how often you have your contact days, how much work you do at home. So it's very, in a sense, it's very student driven, which mm-hmm. is really nice.
Yes. Yes, because you wouldn't think that. Anybody just coming to it cold would not think that would be the approach. But it's good to know that there's that flexibility is within it.
There is, and it's, yes, it's a formal teaching situation, but it's not like in a classroom and you're all doing the same thing. So I'm really, really lucky in that one of their satellite locations is about 3 miles from me.
No.
So that's where I'm doing it. It's not nearly so, rugby is not nearly so decorative as Hampton Court Palace, I can tell you that. But, you know, most of the time you're looking at your embroidery. So really, having a 17th century garden outside is all very well, but you don't need that all the time. And so this is actually what made it possible for me to do it. Because mm-hmm. if I had to travel to London every time, it would just not be doable.
Right.
So I go there. I decide which of the days that they offer. Obviously, not quite as many as at Hampton Court Palace. I think they offer about 8 days a month. And you book yourself in and you tell them which module you're on. Depending on how many people have signed up for that particular day, you'll have one or two tutors. The first two classes I did, there was just the one tutor. Both times I had Angela Bishop, with whom I'd done several day classes before. So that was quite nice because I pretty much knew her. And there were about six people in total. And several people were doing crewel work, and one person was doing stump work, and one person was doing black work. And they're all doing their own thing, and Angela sort of flits about getting everybody working and then goes from one person to the next seeing what they need. So out of the, it's 10 till 4 with an hour off for lunch, which they do insist you take because you go absolutely googly-eyed if you don't do that.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
and brain fried and everything. And so in that 2 till 4, 10 till 4 day, it's not as though you've got 10 till 4 tutoring. Mm-hmm. Because she's doing six people. But on the other hand, you know, if she said to you, okay, well, get started on that little hillock in your design and do that in whatever stitch you've chosen, she will help you if you need help to show how the stitch is done. She will set you a certain practice piece and might say, okay, get on with the practice piece. Then I'll be back after I've been to all the other people and come and show you and see how well you're doing, what you could change, what you could improve. So, it's a really nice, for such a formal course, it's actually quite a nice informal atmosphere.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There's a structure, but it sounds like a very relaxed atmosphere to it.
It is. And it's just, you know, six or seven people in a room who all really enjoy embroidery. Mm-hmm. And everybody has a look at everybody's work and, you know, sometimes you'll look at something and say, I really, really like that stitch combination, and bear it in mind for your own work, as you might be able to use it in part of your design. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things which sort of threw me when I was doing my design for the crewel work embroidery. 'Cause one of the things in the certificate is that from the very start, you always work with your own designs. So none of the certificate bits are here is a design and we're all doing the same thing. From the start, you're designing. And
yeah, I got a sense that as much designing as you've done, that kind of threw you for a loop a little bit.
In a sense, what was nice was that it was designing within parameters. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we get back to the point you originally made about versatility and so on. If you can do 100 things and you're then getting down to trying to design something, occasionally it can throw you because which of all these things do you use? So sometimes you can start throwing things in just for the heck of it, really, because you can. Or in some cases, I have made designs overcomplicated, in a sense, because I was afraid of cheating people by giving them something too simple. Sort of think, oh gosh, I can't possibly charge for this. You know, it's yeah. so simple. I must throw in another stitch, and then you find that actually that other stitch makes it a much less effective design.
Mm-hmm.
So that can paralyze you if it strikes you like that. Actually, I found that most designs that I get in my mind would suggest their own technique. So if I have an idea in my head, I would tend to think of it right from the start as a gold work design or a freestyle design or whatever. But here I was given very, very clear parameters. So the design for the Cruel module is a tree of life. It's sometimes known as Jacobean embroidery, Cruel embroidery, because it was very popular in the Jacobean age. And a lot of its popular design motifs and themes come from that time. And one of the themes that was very popular in those days was the Tree of Life, which tended to be very, very stylized, you know, very sinewy stems and trunks, and then enormous leaves and flowers, and completely wrong proportions. You know, you'd have a tiger on a hillock, and then you'd have a rabbit, which was about half the size of the tiger. So they're asking you to design something that is within that tradition. And recently they've started giving you another limitation, because they found that people were put off by all the possibilities that they had. So they're now saying you get to choose a very limited color palette.
Oh.
You have two main colors, each of which you can have in five shades, and you can have two contrast colors, which I think also have to be two shades of a single family, color family. So that rather concentrates the mind, because as you said about the Hardanger, I'm very much a color person. And so to me, I think that was the thing that challenged me most. So in the end, I ended up with turquoise and muted brown with two shades of orange for my contrast colors. And I'm still working out which colors are going to go where.
Uh-huh.
That was another thing which was really surprising. I've had two contact days. They suggest 8 contact days for a module and about the same amount of homework. So 8 full days of doing work at home, although you can do more if you want to. So I've had 2 contact days, which is a quarter of my module,
mm-hmm.
and I've not actually done a stitch on the actual embroidery yet.
Oh, no.
And I'm told this is not at all unusual.
Oh.
So the first contact day was slightly thrown by the fact that I moved... I'd made use of a place that became available at the very last moment. And so I started about a month earlier than I'd originally intended, which meant that they didn't have the slate frame there, which was which I'd asked for. I'd asked for their smallest slate frame, and small in this case is absolutely relative. It's huge. And so I was there... coming there to do my embroidery, and I didn't have a slate frame. I didn't have an embroidery frame. So you'd have thought, well, what do you do from 10 till 4? Actually, quite a lot, because there was all the deciding on the colors and working on the design. And so I got most of my design done on that day. That was the first thing I did. Then the second contact day, they did have the slate frame. And then you get into the whole business of dressing the frame, which simply means putting your fabric on it. And I say simply, but it isn't. I think that took me more than half the day. And I am told confidently that over time you get quicker at it, which I sincerely hope is the case.
Because at this juncture, it takes forever.
Oh my goodness. I mean, so far, I have been the sort of person who whacks a bit of fabric into a hoop and then off I go.
Right.
So this was a bit of a shock to the system, really. but it was interesting. And it was, once you started lacing up the sides and you're working with a bracing needle, which you could probably kill people with if you're not careful. and it's oddly mesmerizing. You sit there pulling the threads through and pulling everything tight and sewing on enormous quantities of herringbone tape. And, you know, once I got it set up, yes, the tension is absolutely incredible.
So it's worth it then.
Well, I don't know yet because I haven't stitched with it yet.
Actually put a needle through. but you really do get a very, very tight all the way around.
You do.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
definitely. Now, I've got a Millennium frame, and that does really, really good what I might call vertical tension, so top to bottom tension.
Yes.
And in fact, for a frame that only holds the fabric top to bottom, the side tension is remarkably good. So when you've got it tightened up completely, if you sort of tap the fabric all the way towards the edge, it's only when you come to the last centimeter of fabric towards the edge that you feel it give,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty impressive.
Yes.
But this one, of course, it's right to the very edge. It's all, you could, you know, throw a coin on it and it bounce off. And so I'm looking forward to trying that. What I was really impressed with was some of the people who'd completed their module, and they were taking their fabric off the slate frame in order to mount it. And I don't know if you've done freestyle embroidery, especially if it's quite dense stitching. Very often when you take it out of the hoop or off the frame, it'll start puckering in between your stitches. Because it had this enormously good tension, and then it comes off and it sort of crumples. And you can iron it all you want, but it's not going to straighten it out because of all the dense stitching in between.
Right.
And with this one, they took it off the frame, and it was just absolutely flat as a board.
Really?
In between all that heavy, and, you know, crawl embroidery, it's sometimes the stitching gets so thick it's difficult to get a needle through. So there are good quantities of wool on that twill uh-huh. fabric, but it was absolutely flat. There wasn't a crease, there wasn't a wrinkle. And so if that's the effect of it, then
that's worth everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But only for fairly sizable projects. I mean, you wouldn't set it up for a, you know, a 4-inch square little thing, because that would definitely be overkill.
So is it, I'm most curious about the slate frame, mm-hmm. because someone has suggested for the Queen sampler that Vaughn and I are going to work on that the slate frame might be an option, because we're trying to decide how to do it. I hope we'll have decided by the time people hear this, because it'll be a couple of weeks. But so I've been curious about the slate frame, and I've been watching very carefully as you put that together, because it looked like it, it always looks like it's a good challenge just to get set up. And
Oh my goodness, yes, it is.
and I've heard from in many instances where if this is not a fairly long-term project, don't bother.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I would definitely, however good this is, and, you know, once I'm done with a certificate, I'll have the slate frame, so I might as well use it. I think I might use it for, say, fairly large gold work, because I've done some gold work projects where I did get that puckering, because gold work, of course, is quite heavy materials on your fabric. And so I got that puckering and rippling in between your stitches when you take it off when you take the tension off. So if the slate frame can cause that not to happen, then I would be very tempted to use it for that sort of thing. But yeah, but I'm not sure I would. It would definitely not be my go-to frame.
Mm-hmm.
But that's partly because I'm on the whole a small project girl, so you know it's simply not worth it.
Because, yeah, you had to, not only the frame, and you said you have a fairly small one, but then you got to hold it with something. So you went through a couple of hoops just to have a trestle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And IKEA to the rescue.
Oh, absolutely. I had vaguely hoped that I might be able to use it with, because I'd gone for the 18-inch slate frame. And in my naivety, I figured that it would be about 18 inches square, which it most definitely isn't. It's 26 inches square with all the bits sticking out and so on.
Oh, my.
So I'd hoped that I would be able to use it with my Aristo lap stand, which I use with the Millennium frame. Uh-huh. But the moment I saw it, I sort of thought, oh, absolutely not a hope. It will need trestles. And David and I, once a year, we do a trade fair because we do the vintage car bits. And we go down to the Bewley Auto Museum and do an annual trade fair. And for that, we have a stand and we have a marquee and we have trestles. And so we picked two of those up. And at that point, I didn't have the slate frame, so I had to use the Millennium frame, which was more or less equally wide. I had a go with that. And, you know, that sort of worked. I mean, they're a bit rough and ready, and they don't look particularly nice, but they were fairly usable. They didn't mm-hmm. tilt, obviously, so that was a bit of a drawback.
Yeah.
And the option right at the other end of the scale in quality and budget and everything is the set that the Royal School of Needlework have in their shop, which I think are handcrafted from all sorts of wonderful woods, and they do look beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they have little pins and so on, and you can tilt and all sorts of things. They are absolutely gorgeous. They are also £550.
Ouch.
Exactly. Ouch is just about right. And I thought, look, I'm going to use them for this certificate, and I may do the odd thing on the slate frame after that, but it's not as though I'm going to be using them all the time. I mean, you know, somebody like Mary Corbett, she's got them in her studio and she uses them for all sorts of wonderful things. And it's worth her while getting really, really good ones. But for me, I didn't think that was really a justifiable expense.
Yeah.
And so the education manager at the Royal School of Needlework said, well, you know, some people get them from IKEA. So I went into their catalogue and found a pair which they tilt. They are height adjustable. They're, you know, you can obviously see that they are made out of odds and ends of wood. They're not handcrafted from tropical hardwood or whatever.
Right.
And they probably won't last 10 generations, but they were £50 for the pair.
There we go. Now we're talking.
Well, exactly. So, you know, three generations down the line, they can buy some new trestles if they really need them. And they work. They, if I have them at the sort of mildest tilt, the frame will just lie on it and be perfectly secure. Even if I tilt it a little bit more, it's still reasonably secure. I might need to put some tabs on the bottom of the trestles then to keep it from sliding off, but mm-hmm. I don't think I'll use it at that. So, you know, they work really well. And the only thing that makes them a little less usable than the Royal School of Needlework ones is that they're shaped like an A-frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm fortunately not too chubby, so I can fit in between. But if you take up a bit more room, it's difficult to get yourself in between the trestles in order to get close enough to the frame. But you know, I tried it out and it worked, and it's a good reason for keeping the diet going. And you know, it's all a good encouragement.
I can't eat that. I need to fit inside the trestle. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yes. Yes. What more encouragement can you need?
So that's worked out well then, because I'm fascinated by the slate frame anyway, just because of the tension it puts all the way around. And I have a Millennium frame, and I have to say, of the scroll frames I've used, I've not seen anything like it. I mean, it does a wonderful job of keeping tension.
It does, yeah.
And the Sarah Brazier that I'm working on now, is the cloth is 36 inches across, and you get into the middle, and it's still quite tension is quite good in the middle, however you want to say that. So that's impressive, but the slate frame just seems to give that extra level.
It does. Mind you, I have found doesn't quite work for the sort of samplers that you're working on, mm-hmm. and that sort of size work. But last year I did a class with Angela Bishop doing the medieval embroidery. And they said, okay, bring a hoop, preferably bound. And I'd never bound a hoop in my life, and honestly, life's too short, and so on. But I thought, I'm going there to learn after all, so why not? And I bound my hoop, and I thought, gosh, what absolute faff, and it had better be worth it. And in fact, it turned out to be worth it.
Yes, it is. Some people I can't believe you've never bound a hoop.
Not before last summer, no. And some people I know bind both hoops, the inner and the outer, which is, I think, quite a good idea if you're trying to protect the fabric. Because whatever I do always fits inside the hoop that I use, I don't tend to bother. I just do the inner hoop. Yeah. And that gets some really good tension. I mean, I've got a, let me just grab that. I've got a deep hoop or a quilting hoop here, which is 10 inches, I think, possibly 12. Is it 12? Yeah, no, it's 10. Which has my doodle cloth for the crewel module.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in a bound deep hoop. And, you know, that gives a good, you can play the tambourine on that.
Yeah.
Right up to the middle. It's not nearly so taut as the slate frame, but it's, you know, it's good and workable. Yeah. So, anybody working with a hoop, I can now, I've been converted. I can now,
she's now an evangelist.
Go on. Yeah. Bind your hoops, everybody. Especially because, I mean, I'm a little bit obsessive about binding hoops. I want them to look absolutely beautiful and all the wraps to be the same width and so on. And so it takes me forever and gives me cramp in my hands. And even then, you know, I can do two in an afternoon. And once they're bound, they're bound. But if you look at the video on the Royal School of Needlework website, where they show you how to bind a hoop. I mean, you know, I sit there grinding my teeth because she just takes torn strips of calico and winds them around any old how with.
Oh, really?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
And I sit there sort of shouting at the screen, going, no, no, that looks awful.
How sloppy.
But it obviously works. So, you know, it doesn't even have to take you a lot of time.
I'm with you. Mine are twill tape, the Mary yep. Corbett video twill tape laid right next to each other with no gaps
mm-hmm.
all the way around and then sewn when they come back together. So it's yep. a very smooth, even surface. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I monkey yeah. around for quite a while to get it right.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
But that's
yes,
what,
they
but,
look
but,
beautiful.
Yeah, but you make the point, and I think people need to realize this. Once you do it, that's it.
Yes.
You don't have to redo it.
No, fortunately not. And, you know, possibly after 10, 15 years, something might wear off a bit and you'd have to do it again. But that's in the grand scheme of things, that's hardly particularly
right.
Onerous.
Right.
So, yeah. And, you know, doing the slate frame, one of the things it got me to do was to, you pointed this out when we had a chat beforehand or when you send me things, was to recycle one of my mother's duvet covers, which was an interesting one.
Well, I think that's a great story that you were able to save that and have some use for it.
It is lovely because when my mother died 3 years ago, I had to clear out her flat, and she'd been in that. It was a rented flat, so we only had about 2 or 3 months. She'd been in that since 1973. I'd lived there ever since I was three until I got married. And so it was quite an emotional thing to do. I mean, I'd grown up there. I'd lived there from 3 till 35. Mm-hmm. And whatever I was going to take, I was going to have to take back with me to England. And so that was, you know, what do I take? What do I leave? What do we give to charity? And some of the things that I could take, because they didn't take a lot of space and they were useful, were some of the duvet covers. And one of them I really liked. It had flowers on it. And I got it home and I found that actually some of the seams had gone. So I hand sewed them together. And we got another 3 years of use out of them, which was lovely. And then they were on the bed and I tried to make the bed and suddenly it just went because the fabric was disintegrating. I thought, okay, well, there's no way I can save those as a duvet cover. What on earth am I going to do with them? You know, rag bag, throw them away. And it just didn't feel right. And then that was just the time when I was dressing the slate frame at my second class at the course. And the other stitches, they all had flaps of tissue paper, four flaps of tissue paper attached sort of north, south, east, west, which they then folded to leave open a little square of the fabric that they were actually working on. And so it kept the rest of it clean because mm-hmm. your hands are resting on it and so on. And but one lady had actually made slightly more durable flaps out of calico. And so she just pinned those to the four sides. And then when she was done with this, she could take them off and reuse them for the next project. I thought, yeah. Oh, that's a really good idea. I'll do that with the duvet cover because there's plenty of fabric that's still usable. Except I could see this taking some time because I do not do sewing machines. So I was going to do this by hand. And then my mother-in-law came to stay. And she has been a quilter for years and years and years. And there's nothing that she doesn't know about sewing machines. So I suggested a bit of mother-daughter time, and we set to, and in an afternoon we had these four lovely flaps from the duvet cover, which I can now use, and they'll remind me of my mother, and they'll remind me of my mother-in-law, and it's all rather splendid.
No, that's really great that you were able to repurpose those, and now almost better, I think, because as you're stitching, they're right there.
Yeah,
memories are right there, and
that's just a lovely way of reusing them.
That's fantastic. So, all right, now we got to get on to some of your designs, and Ilka is offering a discount, so we want to make sure we get to that too. But so now that you're into this certificate program, a distance, still going strong, more enthusiastic, a little frustration. How have things gone?
Slight frustration in that I would like to spend more time on the certificate, and most of my stitching time comes of an evening because we have the day job, we run a business, and so it's generally after dinner, which means I don't really get started until 8 at the earliest, and very often not until 9, which is not exactly the right time to start something as challenging as that, because you need to be, you know, you need to be wide awake, and preferably you need a bit of a run at it, not sort of 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. So I'm finding that quite challenging to fit in. And in fact, today, the boss very kindly gave me the day off. So I did some work in the morning, and then I had a good run at doing a lot of practice for the piece, a lot of doodle cloth work. So that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
But of an evening, I sort of do my own stuff, which is generally smaller anyway. Yeah. And so that works quite well. It doesn't fight, if you see what I mean. The certificate is definitely a separate thing for which I have to find extra time, but it doesn't really eat into what I would normally do.
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah, I still find myself coming up with ideas, and I'm not really looking for them. They just sort of come. And sometimes they come from quite unexpected places. I was going to see a friend, and she does a lot of craft, and she paints little pebbles as owls. So they're about what, 2-3 centimeters tall. Mm-hmm. They're quite tiny. And they're, you know, the usual sort of oval, smooth pebble shape. And she paints little owls on them. And I had just chosen my colors for the certificate, which was, as you may remember, turquoise, muted browns, and a bit of orange. And one of her favorite owls she showed me was in turquoise, muted browns, and some orange. And I thought, ooh. Now, there's a thought. So I had a bit of a go. And so now there's Who Me on the website, which is the latest one that I put up, which is a little owl based on that pebble, but also including he's got little claws. I call them toes, but they're claws, really, which the pebble owl doesn't have because pebbles are, you know, smooth and oval. But when I did my first RSN class, one of the ladies there was just getting towards the finishing stages of her crewel module, and her tree of life had an owl in it. And the owl had little claws made out of bullion knots.
Oh.
And I said to her, that's really effective. Do you mind if I take a picture of it and possibly use it in something or other? I knew there wasn't going to be an owl in my crewel piece, so that was fine. And then suddenly this owl pops up and I think, oh, well, he just needs to have these bullion toes.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got those and he's got a branch to sit on because he looked a bit silly having toes with nothing to grab hold of. So there he is. And I've done him in two versions, in crewel wool and in Madeira Lana, which is a slightly thinner wool acrylic blend. So that's the latest design on the website.
Yeah, those are cute. And folks, I'll put a slideshow of some of these designs on the page for this podcast, and then obviously on the FlossTube video, then they'll show up somewhere along the way in the podcast. But mm-hmm. Yeah, they're cute. Are they the designs? What, 4 inches tall? And I don't do metrics, so.
Oh, gosh, much, much smaller.
Very small, then.
The owl comes in two sizes, and the bigger one of the two, if I can use the word big in the context, is 4 centimeters high.
So not even 2 inches, then?
No.
Oh, okay.
So it's really card-sized.
So these are just quick, put-together, cute little things. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, relatively speaking, yes.
Right.
I do. I mean, you're an embroiderer yourself, so you'll have some idea of what sort of time that takes. But I do find that people look at it and say, "Oh, isn't that cute? Could you make me one?" And I'd say, "Well, yes. It does take me several evenings."
I said quick, but yeah, these aren't going to go together in 2 hours. No.
No, but on the other hand, it's not a Sarah Brazier sampler.
Right. Right.
By no means. It is. Yeah. They're nice in between sort of projects. And I'm hoping to possibly turn it into a workshop. So in a little over a week's time, it will have happened by the time this goes out. I'm doing it as a little private workshop with a few friends who like to do crafty things. One of them works in a school, and each of the classes has an animal for their mascot, I suppose you'd say. And one that she's responsible for has an owl. She's like, "Oh, well, they need that one because we've got lots of ceramic owls and so on all around the classroom, but we haven't got an embroidered one." So she's coming and going to embroider one herself.
All right. Well, that's the fun thing about so many of your designs is you make use of needlework for cards, for greeting cards or whatever. You make an awful lot of that and have through the years. And I always think it's a unique niche and fun.
It sort of grew out of, because that's what I did myself. And so I naturally am inclined to design things that will suit that. But I found that actually quite a lot of people want something smallish that is not going to take forever. And, you know, you wouldn't send a card like that to just anybody because they do take time and they do take materials and so on.
Right.
But anything that's, you know, a special birthday or an anniversary or, you know, just a good friend who's moving house or whatever, They're lovely to make, and they're very personal, which is a lovely thing.
Yep, they are. Now you've got several new Hardanger designs. And
they're not new Hardanger designs. I may have misled you when I sent you the pictures. I simply meant they are different pictures from what I sent you before. So they're not actually new. I'm going to admit.
Okay, that's fine. They're new to me, so I'll take them.
They are still there. So yes, one of the ones I really like, which I sent you an example of, is floral lace, which is, I think I sent you the one with the fuchsia flower on it.
Yes.
It's a set of 20. It started out as two, and then I came up with some more and then some more. And then it was a set of 18. And then I did two more because I wanted to do something for Remembrance Day. So I did one with poppies and one with rosemary, because rosemary is for remembrance. So that made the total 20. It does grow a bit.
Yeah.
And I like them because they have cross stitching, which is what I started out with. So it's sort of going back to my roots. They've got a tiny bit of Hardanger in there. So if somebody knows how to do cross stitch and they would like to do a little bit of Hardanger, this is just the thing to get them into it. And it also shows that even with a teeny bit of cut work, it looks really effective and really quite impressive as well. Yes, I really like those. And they use some beads and they use some color. And if you have the whole set, it's a great variety of filling stitches and bars. So they're quite a good teaching aid as well, really.
And these are all about 4 inches on a side?
I'm going to have a quick think now because I haven't got them with me, but about that 4 or 5 inches
four or five
max,
inches, yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and I will just say I first got exposed to Hardanger through Ilka and a couple of her stitch-alongs, and all of her designs in those were about that size. And
right,
it's wonderful because it you can finish them, they're approachable, and like she said, you do get to do like this floral lace thing. I mean, there's some cross stitch, there's some bead work, there's just a little bit of Hardanger, so you can just get your feet wet, and you end up with a nice little piece that doesn't take forever, and you learn some techniques. And if you're a cross stitcher, you still have that home base of comfort. And that's what I've loved about these little Hardanger designs you do is they are very approachable. And you can get just enough out of them, and there's color in them. You put color in, and it's very easy to change the colors to something you like.
Yep.
And instructions are good, and you can just go through, and you end up learning a new technique without it being painful or testing or anything like that. And you just get just a little bit, and then you have others that have a little bit more, and it's they're fun to do.
Takes you along. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Well, what you said about instructions, one of the things, because I used to learn everything from books, instructions were, of course, very, very important, because you just have to make do with what it says in the book. You can't ask the author what they meant with this or that or the other. And I found that some of them were extremely frustrating. There was one book which otherwise was, you know, perfectly good book, learnt a lot from it, but it showed you four-sided edging, which is a really good way of finishing off a small item, because it gives you a really durable edge. You know, you can pull it and it won't come apart, and it's great for making little patches or coasters or whatever. And it showed how to do it along the straight edge, and then it said, then turn the corner. This is like recipes which tell you cook until done.
Right.
They are infuriating because it didn't say how to turn the corner. And actually, it's quite complicated. And I worked it out after a while. But when I started using that stitch in my own designs, I wrote the instructions specifically to say, this is how you turn the corner.
Yep.
Because it had frustrated me so much, I didn't want people who got my chart packs to feel the same. And so, you know, this is a call to anybody who buys any of the chart packs. If there's anything in there that you think, yeah, that could be a bit clearer, could you please, please tell me, because I will rewrite it. Because what I really want is for people to be able to pick that up, even if they've done no hardanger before or no freestyle embroidery or whatever it is they pick up, and to be able to do it from the instructions. But I do always say in workshops as well, you know, they all come with the aftercare package, which means you've got my email address. Drop me a line if there's anything that you don't understand, and I'll try and work it out with you.
Right. All right, one more. This one just really catches my eye to the point where I may just do it. And that's the Bible cover or the book cover. Such an elegant piece, and you stayed with white on white.
Sort of. It's actually, you can't tell, but it's a really, really light blue.
And it is.
It uses Caron threads. And I think that particular shade is called Moonshine or Moonlight or something like that.
Well, there isn't much color to it, is there? Wow.
It is very, very light. And so that was just about as close to traditional as I got. And that is the reason it's called Lviv, L-V-I-V, is because it's one of the Ukrainian-inspired pieces. And I named them all after something Ukrainian-based, Lviv being one of the main cities there. So, yes, that's based on Ukrainian white work. That's the version, the one I gave you the picture of, is the version in pretty much white on white. I did the same thing in a variegated, very colorful variegated thread on cream. And you can't tell from the picture, but actually, if you turn the Bible over, that's the other half of the cover.
Oh.
And if you go to my website and go to the gallery, there's a gallery of sort of finishes and things. You'll see both sides there. And it's remarkable how different they look. And very recently, I did a design of mine called Cross My Heart, which originally was done in variegated Caron threads, pinkish, yellowy pinkish and sort of strawberry colors on white. And then in an exchange, I was given a lovely piece of hand-dyed fabric in the brightest, brightest fuchsia pink that you can think of, and all sort of mottled. And I thought, it's lovely, but what on earth am I going to do with it? Because it was really, really striking. And so I did the Cross My Heart design in bright white on this very bright pink. And it works. But gosh, it looks completely different. So I haven't actually put that on the website yet, but I will as a contrast, just to say, you don't have to stick with the colors I tell you, you know, experiment, and it will look completely different. You can make it your own.
Yeah. Well, this Bible cover, there's such an elegance to it. It really is beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorites, I think. Yep. All right, so we got to wrap this up. Man, I tell you, I hate that. Now you're going to have to come back and we're going to have to do more. So that's how it works. So for people who are interested, just Ilka has been kind enough to offer a 10% discount on anything digital on her site. So anything you can download on her site. And then you can get 10% off on one item in the tools and kits section. So as she described it, anything that requires postage, you can get 10% off of one item. You can order 10 items, but just 10% off of one. And I highly recommend, especially if you're going to do hardanger, getting a pair of her squizzers, which are
definitely my favorite tool, I must say.
Yes, yeah, because cutting the fabric with those things is so much easier than regular scissors. It's worth owning, and you know, I've owned those now for quite a while. And I have found more uses. I keep them by my stitching all the time because I find them to be useful for things other than hardanger. They're very, very handy thing to have.
They're quite versatile. I think originally they were designed for people with arthritis who couldn't get their fingers into ordinary scissor holes, finger holes. And so they're quite useful for that as well. Just a little clarification. You say anything you can download. You can't actually download things from my site. If it was automatic downloads, I'd have to charge VAT.
Oh,
which,
oh really?
I know. Oh, tell me about
it.
Come
on, you guys. They got to lighten up.
I know. But because I email things out and therefore it is not automated, I don't have to charge VAT, which is always very useful. So if you email me with the code that Gary's going to put on the site and just tell me what you want, I can also combine postage then if you want more things from the postage section. Yes, if you buy more than one thing from the tools and kits section, I'll give you the 10% off the most expensive item.
There we go. So the order goes to Fancies, and I'll put this on the page for the website. The order goes to Fancies, FANCIES, at mabelfigworthy.co.uk, and your code is FiberTalk10. And
that's right.
And you send the email with the order to Ilka, and then she'll take it from there and email you the pieces or ship them or however it needs to be done. And the offer is good through the end of July. So 2 weeks of time to take advantage of this. And lots of, you know, folks, I mean, I'm just going to do a little sales pitch for Ilka here. Lots of little designs that go in little frames on cards. And then you still have the cards. You can buy the cards that are already cut out to put them in. And
you can, yes. Unfortunately, my regular supplier has been taken over by somebody else, and so they are still finding their feet a bit, but they should be sort of getting up and running a bit more. They're called Craft Creations if you're in the UK, but there's bound to be places in the US that do them as well.
I would think so, yeah.
Or you can just cut your own.
Right, yeah, that's always an option. But lots of little things like that, little projects you can take with you that you can make into all manner of things, including that Humi Owls. Those look like fun, yes. Yep.
Yes, they were great fun to do, I must say.
Yes.
And just one thing I'd like to say is that I have decided to go on with the Sull, another stitch along.
Yes.
But this one's going to be freestyle. It's going to be a Tree of Life, even though I started it long, long before I even thought of doing the Royal School of Needlework class. And I'm going to put that up on the 1st of July, so that should be up by the time this goes out.
So that would be a 6-month or 12-month?
10 installments. So it's going to run from January to May, end of May, starting January 2020. And yes, you're going to be learning all sorts of stitches, and I'll make sure that quite a lot of the installments will have two or three different versions that you can try, and you know, you'll be learning lots of surface embroidery stitches or practicing them if you already know them.
And, so available to sign up in July?
No, not yet. In July, I'm going to put up the information page, so that will tell you everything you need to know about when it's going to happen, what you're going to, when you're going to learn what you need, and so on. So that's the initial information page, and sign up is going to be probably towards November. If anybody wants to sort of sign up for being told about it, then by all means, drop me an email and I'll put you on the list.
Excellent. And I'll put a link up for that. And I will just, again, I'll just do a sales pitch. She does a wonderful job with these stitch along progressive things. The two Hardanger ones that I did, never completed the second one, but she took us from the most basic, and each one was a progression to the next level, and I really learned a lot quickly. Instructions are really good, all of those things. So
thank you.
No brag, just fact. Really well done. It was really easy to follow, and something I'd had zero exposure to when I started, and just took it just because, hey, that looks like fun. I got to try this. And I got to learn what it's like to actually cut ground cloth intentionally. And turns out not a big deal.
I like that as a description, cutting ground cloth intentionally.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. That was the thing, because I'll never forget that first time. All right, I think I have everything just right. I think I know exactly where I'm going to cut. grit my teeth and go for it. And all the yep. way in the you know, afterwards I thought, this is a 4-inch piece of cloth that cost yep. me, you know, next to nothing. What am I sweating over? But
well, it was one of the reasons why I wanted to keep it small, because if you know, a lady at one of my stitching groups is doing a tablecloth. She's been working on it for 3 years.
Mm.
It's enormous. And you do all the surface embroidery before you start the cutting.
Oh.
Just imagine having worked on that for 3 years and then your final cut goes wrong. You really don't want that as your starting thing. So, so these small ones are just the right size to have a go. And, you know, if something does go wrong, no great loss. And actually, there's very, very little that you can't in some way salvage.
Right. Well, that was just it. You know, I'll never forget that first time I cut. I don't know. It's just one of those things that's just ingrained mm-hmm. in me. But I had made up several pieces of cloth all the same size, so I had one for mm-hmm. each month. And when I got done, and it went well, but when I got done, I thought, why was I so worked up? There's this stack of cloth over here. I just do another one. And and it would have been fine. But so that mm-hmm. it's a great way to learn. It really is.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, that's the only pitch. That's the end of my sales pitch for Ilka right there.
well, it's much appreciated. Thank you.
All right, we got to end this thing. Ilka, thanks so much. Always good to chat with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks for listening. Remember now, #FiberTalkMadeMeBuyIt gets you off the hook if you spend money. And please mention when you do that you heard about it on Fiber Talk. And if you're interested in sponsoring a show, let me know. Thanks, Ilka, once again. Always fun.
Thank you.